It's Friday, and it's our week in review, and we are dedicating the hour to taking your calls with our analysts on the events this week around race, racism, and brutality in America, including the killing of George Floyd. We just heard from Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins before the break. Now I want to bring our analysts into the conversation. Joining us on the line is Michael Curry of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. He's also former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Welcome back, Michael.
Thank you, Tiziana. Glad to be here.
Also with us is Renee Landers, professor of law and director of the health law concentration at Suffolk University. Renee, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here, Tiziana.
And Tito Jackson, CEO of Verdant Medical and former Boston City Councilor. Tito, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Tiziana.
And listeners, pull up a chair. Out of Minneapolis and the events this week, what is the headline for you? How are you reacting? Share your thoughts at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. All right, so with our analysis, I want to start to reactions to what you just heard from Rachel Rollins. Renee Landers, let me invite you to go first.
Oh, thank you, Tiziana. Well, I think that she, that the district attorney did a very good job of recapitulating the history of police violent interactions with particularly African-American communities in the country. It was also good to hear her say that most police officers do not engage in the kind of behavior that led to the death of Mr. Floyd in Minneapolis this week. And I thought that her call to action for people of goodwill not to remain silent in the face of these things was really quite good. And that's a useful reminder to everyone that just sort of sighing and feeling sad about it isn't enough, that people of goodwill have to make their voices heard about what's wrong when situations like this occur, including the police officers who were witness to the event.
Tito Jackson, let me invite you to add your voice there.
So I think, one, acknowledging the heroic work of a Bostonian, Marilyn Mosby, who was actually from Dorchester and was the DA in the Freddie Gray case. We need DAs who have the backbone to charge. I actually disagree with the third degree charge that was put forward because
third
it's actually
third degree
murder charge that was forward in this case, based on the fact that it in their state says that there's a lack of intent to actually kill. But I think what DA Rollins actually brought up is so important when she frames it as every city in America is one incident away from what is happening in Minneapolis. And it is critical that every city, including the city of Boston, actually looks at our inequality, our process, and the manner in which we conduct ourselves here, and use this as an opportunity to actually look in the mirror and deal with the inequalities that actually exist right here in the city of Boston. So I think that's a critical component, and I appreciate DA Rollins' work on being on the ground on a regular basis and being the voice of the people who put her in office.
So Michael Curry, you were on just yesterday. You and I were talking about voting in the fall. I don't think either of us imagined, or maybe you did, the next round of events that would happen in Minneapolis last night, and we'd be here talking about it this way today. How are you feeling today?
I would say angry. No surprise. There's a Latin phrase that DA Rollins knows, and any of us who've been trained in the law or attended a school that taught Latin knows. It's called res ipsa loquitur, and that means the thing speaks for itself. You don't have to know more than what you saw in that video to know that Officer Chauvin murdered George Floyd. But we know the script. We know how this will play out. They will argue whether he was intoxicated, whether he made some movement. We've seen this across the country that if you are African-American and you are murdered by a police officer, there's always an excuse as to why they murdered you. Credit to DA Rollins. You know, I'm a huge fan of what she's doing here in Suffolk County. I think we've been watching her from across the country. The National NAACP is preparing to have her be part of a national conversation about her work here. The only thing I would disagree with her and many others who seem to lift this up is this notion that most police officers don't do this kind of stuff. I was born and raised in Roxbury. I saw police officers brutalize Black men and then drop them back off on the same court as they arrested them on. We don't know whether this is 2% or 98%. And ultimately, we'd like to believe that most officers don't do this. Maybe they don't kill you, but they violate your rights when you're African-American. Maybe they rough you up. Maybe they trump up charges and accuse you of attacking them with a shod foot. Those are the kind of things we see in the legal profession where they're trumped up charges. Last but not least, this is not new for Minneapolis, St. Paul. I went to college there, 1987 to 1991. An elderly couple in 1989 was murdered when the police shot a flash bang grenade through their apartment, had the wrong apartment of some apartment they were trying to raid. And they killed that elderly couple. And we as activists, me as a student activist at that time, was marching the streets protesting against the murder of that elderly couple. It is not new for Minneapolis and St. Paul. It is not new for Boston. It is not new for any major city or town in this country. When do we wake up and actually do something about it?
So I really want to give both Renee and Tito a chance to respond to you, Michael, and to let us know how each of you are feeling today. It's almost an inadequate question, and yet not checking in just doesn't make any sense. So I asked you both to react to D.A. Rollins, but how are you both today?
Well, it is very sobering. It's very sobering to see what's happening in Minneapolis. I think I would agree with Michael that we actually don't know what happens in a lot of police interactions. And we would like to believe that police interactions are mostly honorable. But I do think that what's happening in Minneapolis today is an expression of a really long history of disadvantage and inequality in the legal system and in the economic system, just basically in the society based on race. New York Times had a piece today, pointing out that African Americans in Minneapolis have 1/3 the earnings as much of whites in Minneapolis, that they have lower high school graduation rates, higher unemployment, and less accumulated wealth. And this current situation all comes out of the history of segregated education, which is actually continues to this day, despite legal changes. And the fact that there was rampant employment discrimination throughout the history of the country, which continues today. And also things like restrictive deed covenants that limited the where in communities African-Americans could purchase homes, which and those restrictions limited the ability for African-American families to accumulate wealth. So I think what you're seeing today is not just a reaction to the what happened to Mr. Floyd, but it's accumulated anger and frustration that about these societal issues that seem not to to ever get to the top of the agenda for addressing in our country.
So our calls are filling up quickly. Before I go to the first call, Tito Jackson, I just want to give you a chance to voice in here too.
So I'm angry, frustrated. I feel triggered. And I'm just tired. I actually came down with COVID, and I'm very happy I didn't have to go to the hospital, and I'm better now. But there's a disproportionate number of Black folk who have contracted that potentially fatal disease. Our healthcare outcomes in the city that has some of the best hospitals in the whole world are actually worse, and we're dying at higher rates. To see this and to see someone who's 1 year older than me killed in front of my eyes, that's absolutely triggering. And then you see all of the other components. Christian Cooper, you have a Black man who he's a birder, and he can't. I never thought we would have to do hashtag that Black birders matter. But a Black man in the park actually just birding and actually having the police called on him and potentially having that person, this individual, have the same outcomes as Ahmaud Arbery or in this case, Mr. Floyd. So there's a lot that we need to be thinking about.
We have that sound from Amy Cooper calling the police on Christian Cooper in Central Park after he asked her to meet local requirements and keep her dog on a leash. Let's just listen to that for listeners who may not know it.
Please take your phone off.
Please don't come close to me.
I'm taking pictures and calling the cops.
Please call the cops.
I'm going to tell them there's an African-American man threatening my life.
Please tell them whatever you like.
I'm sorry, I'm in the Ramble, and there is a man, African-American, he has a bicycle helmet. He is recording me and threatening me and my dog. There is an African-American man, I am in Central Park. He is recording me and threatening myself and my dog. I'm being threatened by a man in the Ramble. Please send the cops immediately.
And I want to note that after that, she issued an apology. She was fired from her job. She actually gave the animal back to the animal rescue where she'd gotten it. But that was at the beginning of a week where we then had an illustration of what can happen to an African-American man when the police are called on him. And it is a strong juxtaposition. I'd like to pick up at least our first caller here, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. We've got Eric on the line from Burlington. Eric, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I guess the other day online, I saw a picture comparing Colin Kaepernick kneeling during the national anthem and the cop that was on George Floyd's neck. And I guess it kind of messed me up a little bit. Like, we have people that get mad when someone kneels during a national anthem, expressing their First Amendment right to express how they want. But there's no outrage over innocent African Americans dying for just being black. And I guess it's just a double standard that I don't see, that I don't understand how one can cause so much outrage over something so little, and then a man's death, crickets, and different
Thank
communities.
You for that,
that's
Eric.
All I got.
Thanks, Eric. Michael Curry, what about that?
Yeah, I saw that image as well and even posted it on my Facebook page. I think it's a powerful image. It's ironic that you have Colin Kaepernick, who was trying to bring attention to police misconduct and police abuse, and you had a good percentage of America, I would argue mostly white, many law enforcement, take offense to his political statement about the systemic racism, the institutional racism in this country, and they missed the point. And then you have a man in similar position kneeling on the neck of George Floyd, literally watching the life leave his body for 8 to 10 minutes. And I know, I feel very strongly that this too is America, that those same people will not be nearly as aggravated, frustrated, and willing to protest and challenge law enforcement that allows a man to take a black man's life without his ability to defend himself or his having his due process.
Michael, there are protests all over the country this week. Maybe I'm missing your point, but I mean, part of what's been remarkable about this week, or at least notable, that's probably a better word, is that there have been protests, not only in Minneapolis, but in other parts of the country, Ohio, Colorado, Oregon. So I just want to make sure I'm understanding you.
Yeah, so I'm not talking about those of us who protest every time we have one of these cases, right? Because we were out there with Tamir Rice, Eric Garner, back to Amadou Diallo, right? We've been here before. It is that other half of America, that 40% that we tend to see in these polls that are not showing up, that don't seem to get the point about how this too is America. America can be racist. And whether it's a police officer who brings their prejudice and their biases into the work, or a teacher or a guidance counselor, and it plays out in a classroom or on a street corner, we got to come to the reality that racism exists in this country. And occasionally it takes lives. And we occasionally pay attention when it takes a life.
I want to back a second to, Renee, go ahead, jump in, go.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to say really quickly that I think the Colin Kaepernick juxtaposition is evidence that there's just a lot of faux patriotism. It's very easy to, you know, get all choked up over, you know, a perceived disrespect of the flag or the national anthem or criticizing the military. But that's the real the real patriot is the person who's concerned about due process and what Rachel Rollins talked about the police not using their tremendous power to harm indiscriminately and without really, really significant justification. So I would really encourage the public to really think about what it means to be a patriot. It's not just waving the flag or singing the national anthem before a football game.
Let's also talk about—
Let's grab another—
Okay, go right ahead.
Go ahead, Tito. No, go ahead. I'm going to grab a call when you go.
You know, you have Amy Cooper, who worked for Franklin Templeton, which is a finance firm. My question for them is, as a firm, where do you guys stand? Yeah, you fired her because she brought bad press, but I challenge the business community in Boston and other cities to step up, because these structural aspects are things that we also need to be thinking about relative to the education in these cities. You're talking about the disparities that exist in Minneapolis. Well, in Boston, Black folk are worth $8 and white people are worth $247,500. And there's a 33-year difference in life expectancy right in our city. So I think we have to challenge not only the law enforcement community to make these changes, people who are in government and in office, but also the business community to step to the forefront and actually make a statement about what's going on.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. We have Robert on the line from Cambridge. Robert, go ahead.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
So I was a police officer for quite a while. I don't want to say the community, but it's in the eastern half of Massachusetts. And the funny thing is, at the academy, I was one of the few white people. We got along great. There wasn't any of this profiling back in the mid-80s, and I'm actually happy that all four of those Minneapolis police officers got fired, and I hope the rest of them get arrested aside from the first one. But unfortunately, in this world, racism is rampant no matter where you go. I mean, I had an issue that I was expecting John Quinones to come out from What Would You Do? Because I thought this had to be an act, that somebody was so cruel. And it's—
So Robert, I'm going to stop you there, because I'm having a little trouble following you on that second part, that reference, and I don't want to lose the first part of what you said. As a former police officer who is reacting to the firing of the four police officers in Minneapolis and the arrest of one. So thank you. I want to take it back from you there and turn to our panel to respond to that. Tito Jackson, why don't you jump
in? So understand, the other piece that we also have to look at are officers who are excessively complained about. And in this case, you had someone who had 17 prior complaints, also was part of another police-involved shooting. So there's some structural components to the way in which these things get adjudicated. And also, I think what DA Rollins brought up is the question of what's actually happening in Baltimore. When we begin to question, and I'm not a lawyer, but should we have outside prosecutors universally come in and prosecute cases because of the connected and cozy relationship that DAs play relative to working with police? So I think there continue to be some structural aspects, and those types of relationships lead to a third degree murder charge versus charges that are higher, which maybe Michael or I would get if we were in the same situation.
And Tision, if I could—
Yeah, Michael, go ahead.
If I can chime in there. So there's a lot packed in what your last caller said. So one is, I always challenge people to don't go with their gut or their own personal experiences, but go with the data. And the data was, whether the 80s, the 90s, or today, mentality and that kind of behavior is not new. And the data has, whatever data is allowed to be collected, has been bearing that out, right? We're just seeing it play out in videos now and on captured footage. But the reality is, it's not new to America. It's been happening for a long time. We have a diversity issue in law enforcement. We have a training issue in law enforcement. We talk about it here in Massachusetts, but across the country, veterans' preference. Why are we getting mostly white males, whether it's the FBI or local police departments? We're not getting that diversity. We're also not getting proper training. Big up to Lisa Holmes and Commissioner Gross and what they did in terms of retraining how Boston police officers do their work doesn't mean that we're perfect here in Boston, but it means that we had an African-American woman leading that training and giving them training on implicit bias about misuse of power. There's a lot here, decertification of police officers. You should be decertified when you, as Tito said, when you have that many violations and we can't trust you with a gun and a badge, you should lose it.
All right, we have to go to a break, but before we do, I think I'm going to give the last word before the break to one more caller, 1-800-423-8255. We've got Liz on the line from West Roxbury. Liz, go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. And thank you for taking my call. My thing is that this is not new. Since the 80s, Rodney King, wake up, people. And then when the people got outrageous and destroyed the city and stuff, looting and everything, and then it kept happening year and year and year after that, it keeps continuing, and nothing changes. Racism still exists. We have walked, we have prayed, we have kneeled, right, at the football games and everything, and this is still happening? And then just today on Facebook, the cops in New York with T-shirts on, I could breathe, making a mockery out of it.
Liz, I appreciate your call and the passion in it. We can't confirm or deny the Facebook posting the police officers from New York. I don't know about that part, but I hear your passion in the rest, and I think we can pick up on some of those threads, especially, you know, history forward from Rodney King when we come back from a break. We will take a break. We will come back. Michael Curry, Renee Landers, Tito Jackson, stay with us. We're focusing this hour on the violence and brutality in America around race and the death of George Floyd this week in Minneapolis. Our panelists are still with us. They are Michael Curry, former head of the Boston branch of the NAACP, Suffolk University's Professor Renee Landers, and former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson, as well as you. Call us, 1-800-423-8255. What stood out to you from the violence, the protests, and the reactions this week, whether it was the woman in Central Park who called the police on an African-American birder, as we talked about before the break, the killing of George Floyd, or what's happened since? I want to take us back now to just before the break, panelists, when Liz from West Roxbury called and had such a strong and passionate reaction of fatigue. You know, we've been here, we have done everything, and it just keeps happening. I don't know where to go with that, but I just want to get your reactions. There was so much to that. Renee Landers.
I would say it was very moving what she had to say. And I think she's obviously right about the history of this, that we have been here before and the racism continues. I would say that change doesn't happen unless people really want things to change. I forget whether it was Michael or Tito who mentioned, you know, the business community's reaction to some of these things and some of the structural causes of disadvantage. I think that's a very important thing. And I think that, you know, everybody has, you know, implicit bias training in their companies, or many companies do. You know, they say they're interested in hiring a diverse workforce because, of course, you know, the law, you know, prohibits discrimination. But because things just don't change very quickly. And so I think that if people... If people pursued their other business goals with such a lack of results, business really wouldn't be very successful. And I think that this goal of really trying to build a truly more inclusive, equal community needs to be taken much, much more seriously, even if it means some dollars on the bottom line to invest in this kind of inclusive process, I think is really important.
I'd like to take another call here. Oh, no, who jump in? It's so hard when we can't see each other. Normally we make eye contact, and I know you want in.
Renee, spot on. You know, there's an opportunity here for to build back post-COVID and do things different. If we go back to exactly how things were, This is going to happen every single time something like this occurs. We have an opportunity for innovation. We have an opportunity for change, and we have an opportunity for equity. And I think, you know, as Renee noted, you can't have crickets from the business community. And how these economic strata continue to get further and further apart, that has a lot to do with folks who are in pinstripe suits, not only those folks who are in track suits.
And Tiziana, something
Michael
said that I can't let go by without recognizing. So the violence in Minneapolis, and we're seeing it across the country, and we've seen it before, right? I was born in 1968, and cities were burning with the assassination of Dr. King. We can't look at this as just something African-Americans do, right? If you're a student of history, you know that any people that have been mistreated, brutalized, don't have their rights, they're not getting justice, will eventually erupt, right? So that's, I always use the term, that's an explanation, not an excuse. If you're burning down people's property, that's not a good thing, but it's not new for America, right? We used to call it Boston's righteous mob in the American Revolution. We know what happened in the Civil War. We saw in 1908 with the Springfield race riot, where they tore up Springfield, Illinois, to give birth to the NAACP for two black men that were accused of attacks on white women, similar to today in Central Park with the Central Park Five, or even the most recent incident. We know that this is not new. We see white men and women gather in Michigan to protest having to wear a mask and being violent and disruptive over just having to wear a mask, not about having their rights violated, being beaten and killed. So I just want to make sure we don't attribute this violence and anger boiling over to just black folks.
Yeah, you know, it's that makes me think, Michael, of a moment we've had on Twitter this week with the President of the United States yesterday, when he talked about, you know, when the looting starts, the shooting starts. He tweeted today looking to clarify that, as saying people get hurt in riots, but it does echo back to a sheriff in Miami in 1968 who used that phrase to describe what turned out to be an incredibly oppressive strategy to protests in Miami around race. And so we find ourselves in this moment where we're getting different messages across the country from local leadership and national leadership. We heard D.A. Rollins talk about the mayor of Minneapolis, but then we've got the president tweeting things like that. What is it going to take for us to move forward? You know, this is our first week in review in weeks where we haven't talked about COVID-19. There's been a message, we're all in this together. This week, we are not all in this together. How do we start moving forward?
Maybe to offer just an initial thought, as you talk about 1960, I always think about the Watts riots. And I was a student in Minneapolis, St. Paul, learning about African-American American history. And one of the phrases that stuck in my head from the Watts riots was the hate that hate produced, right? I want that to sit with some folks. The hate that hate produced, that's where we are. We're in a country where we've allowed hate to go unchecked, and it's come from Pennsylvania Avenue down to Charlottesville, and it's persisted throughout this whole nation in the mistreatment of African-Americans and many other people of color. And now you see that hate boiling over. If we are going to address this issue, we're going to have to address systemic racism. We're going to have to address whether it's institutional or whether it's in our hearts and our attitudes. And until we do that, this is festering. There will be many more Watts in Detroit's and Roxbury's. And now, as we're seeing play out in Minneapolis, it's a riot waiting to happen.
And we also...
Tito, I heard you want to jump in.
Yeah. So we also, one of the things from a media perspective, in 2014 at the University of Minnesota, after the Frozen Four, which is a hockey tournament, white kids went out and rioted, broke stuff, and lit stuff on fire. So I do want to think, we also, one, have to characterize how we can look at protests, and they were doing it for a sports component. But to Michael's point, I think it's absolutely critical that we kind of contextualize what's happening. One, we have a bunch of angry white people who are walking up into state buildings with guns, right? So they're angry too. And also, many of the rioters or people who are part of this protest, quote unquote, they are white kids, right? And so this component of only showing imagery of folks who are who look like George Floyd and who are angry is something that we need to really think of. And just lastly, we have to begin to think of how we put forward, as you noted, solutions. And so there's structural solutions that, one, start with who you elect as DA, who you elect as city councilor, and who you elect as mayor, but also where finances and resources go, training resources go, and also how these structures actually react to those folks who have been harmed.
Renee, I want to give you a chance to, yeah.
Yeah, we have a president right now. I'm glad you brought up the president's role in all of this, who is uniquely ill-equipped to deal with this situation. You know, a person who ran a real estate company that was cited by the federal government for practicing discrimination in rental housing, you know, who has encouraged these groups of gun-carrying people protesting at state houses and so forth. You know, really done nothing to try to unify the country. He could not even do it over the COVID-19 crisis, which should have been easy. And this one is really hard. And unless there is a change in leadership at the top, there will continue to be mixed messages. There will be a message from the president and then hopefully messages from people like District Attorney Rollins or the mayor of Minneapolis or some others who are trying to set a different example.
Tiziana, we have to also deal with one more piece, as we also need to deal with white liberal racism that tells Black folk how we should get angry and what we should do structurally when we're in these situations. So I think that's another component that we also have to give voice to, and as my young people would say, have to keep it 100 about.
You know, we don't have time to get to any more calls, but I feel like what you guys just said reacted or gave an answer to a call that one of our callers, Anne from Cape Cod, had wanted to ask, which is, as a parent and a citizen who wants to rally behind people who are being mistreated, what can I do? I think we got some answers there. For the rest of our callers, and there were several, I'm sorry that we couldn't get to you. This is a conversation that we will continue to have going forward. We are out of time, and we are certainly not out of conversation, but I really do appreciate the three of you engaging with us on this today. Again, it's just the beginning. That was Tito Jackson, CEO of Verdant Medical and former Boston City Councilor. Thanks for being on Radio Boston today. I appreciate it. Renee Landers, Professor of Law and Director of the Health Law Concentration at Suffolk University. I know this was your first time with us today. Thanks so much for joining us here for our Week in Review.
It was a pleasure. I hope that you'll have me again.
And Michael Curry of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the National Board. Thanks so much.
Tiziana, thank you. And I'm going to encourage people, go to the NAACP national website and get the pictures of We Are Done Dying, hashtag We Are Done Dying, and post it.
All right, and that is our show from today. From our whole staff here, thanks for listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We're going to end today with 12-year-old Kedron Bryant singing in a YouTube video yesterday, which he says was inspired by the death of George Floyd.
Every day, I'm being hunted as prey. My people don't want no trouble. We've had enough, Sean Gold. I just want to live. God, protect me. I just want to live. I just want to live.